This week in Retronauts, lordy lordy, we're looking back 40. Everyone, welcome to Retronauts. Wow, that was a long R. That was like I was French or something. I am Jeremy Parrish, and this week we are talking about old video games. I know that blows your mind, but it's true, we are. And we're kind of dancing around a topic that we tackled earlier in the year, but in a fun and different way. It's like earlier we did, you know, the samba, but now we're doing the cha-cha-cha. So it's a different kind of dance, and it's going to be fun and exciting. So put on some music, put on your tap shoes, dance with us. And who is us? That is what I'm asking here. Who do I have on the show with me? First, let's get our newly minted contributing co-host for the show.
I guess that's me. Hi, I'm Kevin Bunch. I'm a video game historian and newly minted co-host.
And also joining us for the first time in several years.
Hi, this is Rob Russo from the Hardcore Gaming 101 podcast.
And I have asked these fine gentlemen to join me today because they like talking about old video games. And specifically, they know a lot about the era we're going to speak of, which is 40 years ago this month. This episode is episode 547. We're going to be looking back at July 1983, and 40 years ago tomorrow from the initial podcast Patreon release date of this episode, July 14th, 40 years ago tomorrow was the launch of two extremely important video game systems in Japan, the Family Computer from Nintendo and the SG-1000 from Sega, alongside the SC-3000, because they like to make it confusing. And we talked about, you know, the looking back at 50, 40, 30 years ago, the events of those years at the beginning of 2023. But we haven't really gone super in-depth into this one specific section. And we've talked about, you know, these systems a lot, but I really want to look at this topic in the lens of a truly important inflection point for the video games industry and the medium, and just kind of what those systems launched into, what kind of world those systems appeared in. And the fact that it wasn't really evident at the time. Like, we can look back and say, oh, yes, the Famicom launched with Donkey Kong. Well, of course, you know, it was almost arcade perfect. It's amazing. They were setting themselves up for success. But were they really? Like, is that really how people saw it at the time? I would say no, because a whole lot was happening. And it's really hard when you're in smack dab in the middle of history to look around you and say, ah, yes, this is the important thing in history, and this is how it's going to go. No one knew that in 1983. Just like looking around now at all the stupid, crazy, horrible things happening in the world. We don't know which of these is going to end life on the planet and which one's going to be a non-starter. So, you know, it's only going to be when the aliens look back a few centuries from now, they're going to be like, oh, yeah, that was it. That was the moment. But we can't see that from where we stand now. So I'd like to kind of ask everyone to pretend that it's 1983. You're wearing like tube over the calf striped socks and, you know, watching the A-Team tomorrow night on TV. And it's just going to be great. And there's some video games happening in Japan that you don't even know about because there's no internet. So that's where we are right now. So, guys, let me ask you, where were you when all of this was happening? Were you when this was happening?
I don't remember most of this firsthand because I was like 1 year old. So didn't really anticipate I'd have to date myself. I was just going to say I'm an expert on this topic because I am old, but I'm not actually old enough. So I was very much like my dad and my uncle were both very much into computers at the time. And so I saw a lot of not Japanese microcomputers, obviously, but I saw like what, you know, I saw my uncle's like old trash 80 and stuff. And the, you know, when I was a little bit older, but it was already old tech by then. But I think you, the way you described it was exactly right at the time. It was no, everybody kind of knew microcomputers were going to be a thing and nobody was quite sure how that was going to work exactly.
There were so many microcomputers on the market. It wasn't like now where you have Windows and Apple, and then you have like some weird little, you know, Unix-based systems on the side. It was chaos. It was unmitigated chaos. There were like 10 different computer platforms, all like you'd go to the computer store. I'm old enough to remember going to like, you know, Walden Software or whatever, and just seeing like a wall of games, and they'd all be the same game, but they'd all have a little like tag on the side that said, this is for, you know, IBM PC, this one's for VIC-20, this one's for Tandy, this one's for Coco, TI-99/4, you know, just like, it was a mess. It was, and you know, there was a naturally a reckoning that happened around this time. And that's kind of the situation here in the States, but things were very different in other parts of the world. And I want to talk about that too. Kevin, what about you?
I was a whole month old at this point in time. Not really paying close attention to the computer market at the moment. But you're absolutely right. Like you look at any of these old trades or you know magazines, and people are just even the retailers are not happy that there's like 10 different standards of computer. None of them work together. Even ones from the same company in some cases. Like, you can't play VIC-20 games on a Commodore 64 Super or software or what have you. So, yeah, no one was really thrilled with this state of affairs.
Yeah, for people who are only kind of old, you might remember the early days of cell phone kind of adoption, right? Where there were all kinds of different... Every phone had its own OS, right? They might have shared very similar hardware, but they had their own OS and they couldn't really play nice together. And nobody even intended them to. But as Kevin was saying, like nobody liked the situation because if you were developing software, you wanted at least a couple... You wanted to be able to narrow your efforts on a couple platforms, right? So the software people didn't like it. The retailers probably didn't like it for obvious reasons. And the hardware developers, I think, were the first movers on this stuff. The software kind of industry developed around them, but they were very much operating from we're gonna be the standard that takes over. We're gonna have the monopoly. We're gonna set the standard. But nobody could really gain that enough of a foothold. And which brand dominated would depend, as Kevin was saying, really very much depended on what country you lived in at the time.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So everyone, you know, this was an era where everyone kind of had their own homegrown systems. And we take MS-DOS for granted. And it did have a lot of traction at that point. But, you know, Apple II also had a lot of traction. And there was a fair amount of popularity for Apple II in Europe and, you know, in Japan. But Commodore 64 was much bigger in Europe, I think, than it was here initially. And, you know, eventually it did kind of... It did sort of snowball through some somewhat questionable marketing and sales tactics in the U.S., but the C64 was basically non-existent in Japan. Japan had its own, you know, its own family of homegrown computers. You had NEC's computers, which were kind of the dominant standards, but you had Sharp with the X1, you had Fujitsu with the FM7, you had smaller computers. We're going to talk about the MSX later. That kind of some of which stood on the bubble. There was the Tomy Puta, aka the Tomy Tutor, which was kind of a computer, kind of a console, very much like the TI-99/4A. It was disastrous. And of course, you know, in Europe you had the C64, but you also had the Spectrum. You had Acorn making computers. You had BBC making computers. You had all kinds of very specific, you know, very regional, hyper-regional computer makers in different countries, like Germany had its own computer makers and France had their own computer makers. And those systems didn't really spread beyond those borders. So it was just, you kind of went with the computer that made the most sense for you financially and had the features that seemed most interesting and hoped that there would be support for your system going down the road and that, you know, as they upgraded the computer family, you would be brought along with it and that you could upgrade your system and that there would still be software support 3 or 4 years down the road. I think people actually at the time tended to buy computers thinking like, I'm going to be using this thing for 10 years. And that ended up really not being the case at all. And we kind of have gotten into an upgrade cycle where I think people tend to buy new computers every few years or else, you know, if you have a build your own PC, you switch out components and just kind of ship a Theseus it until it's no longer the computer you started with. But at the time, I don't really think that was the case. That was kind of a given. People thought like, I'm going to buy this. Maybe I'll add some expansion capabilities to it, you know, some new power to it when I need it. But I'm going to like this is an investment. I'm spending months and months worth of salary on this one computer. So it's got to last me a long time. And that really turned out not to be the case, which I think was a big turnoff for a lot of people. And, you know, video game systems were the same. And I think when you had like the Atari 5200 come out and offer no support whatsoever for the Atari 2600. And in fact, even though it shared more or less the same hardware design with Atari 8-bit computers, it couldn't play Atari 8-bit computer games. Like that really made some people sour and kind of rubbed them the wrong way. So yeah, you just had kind of an industry trying to figure out exactly how things were going to work and consumers making big expenditures and sometimes, actually probably more often than not, getting burned on it. And it was just a bad, bad scene in a lot of ways.
Yeah, I had a Betamax VCR to prove it. So that was very much like the kind of situation you were getting with all kinds of technology at the time. Like, is it going to be compact discs or is it going to be like digital audio tapes, right?
Right, exactly. And like, you know, I've spent so much money on UMD movies and can I play those on anything now? No, terrible. How am I going to watch Shrek and Talladega Nights? Oh my God.
Yeah, nobody really knew how this was going to work and nobody knew how to sell this stuff to, they knew everybody kind of, they were futurists, right? They're always futurists over there in the tech sector. And they're like, this is going to be big. And for once they were actually right. For a while, everybody did really need a home computer. It just didn't happen quite yet. And so the question is like, how do we take these not especially useful, very primitive microcomputers and convince people that they need them? And that was one of the ideas that some people had was, as you said, like, let's get this, let's sell something that will last for 5 years, not 10 years, but 5 years, maybe 5 years. And we'll do it through like upgradability and, you know, having expansion ports, allowing for RAM expansions later, something like that. There were ideas, but people didn't even know what medium they were going to be selling their software on exactly. Is it going to be cassette tapes? Is it going to be the big floppies or the small floppies? And that wasn't really nailed down in 1983 at all.
Yeah, I would say at the time, there also wasn't like a super hard division between consoles and computers the way that there would be a few years later. I mean, there was, you know, the idea that basically everyone who made consoles had this plan to give you some sort of kit that could convert it into a working home computer. And I think in the US, did anyone manage to deliver on that besides Coleco with the Atom? Kevin, would you know?
So other than Coleco with the Atom, I know sort of Mattel did. They had a keyboard component that was not priced in a way that could actually move. So they tried to not put it out, and then they ended up having to do a test market for it, and that was it. And then in late 83, they put out their ECS computer expansion, which was sort of a midpoint between what they wanted to do with the keyboard component and what they could get away with. And at that point, the Intellivision was just sort of in free fall, so no one really cared, and I don't think it really sold all that well. So Coleco was probably the closest anyone got to that.
Thank you.
Yeah, and if you look over in Japan, where we're really going to start this story, this episode, that kind of blurred boundary was very much in effect. You know, you had some of the early consoles that shipped in Japan. A lot of them were either imported at great cost, like the Atari 2800, which was the 2600 and actually launched toward the end of 1983, much too late to count. The Mattel Intellivision, I think Bandai brought it over and sold it for a crazy high price. Then they brought over the Emerson Arcadia 2001 as the Mattel or the Bandai Aquarius, Arcadia. And that, you know, was too expensive. But then, you know, 1982, you had Tomy release the Tomy Tutor, the Tomy Puta, which was basically, I mentioned that before, a TI-99-4A. And in 1983, they released a consoleized version of it, which literally just took away the keyboard and support for basic programming, but was the same system. You had the MSX launch in the summer of 1983, which was a computer, but really in a lot of ways felt like a console as we think of it today, because it had, you know, cartridges and was really, really game focused. And then, of course, you have the family computer from Nintendo, like the name's right there in the, like the word is right there in the name. And there was, you know, an attempt to give it support for basic programming and data storage with a cassette player and a keyboard in 1984, thanks to Hudson. And of course, you had the SG-1000, which launched alongside the SC-3000, which was the exact same thing, except it had a keyboard and you could do some programming on it. And you could actually turn the SG-1000 into an SC-3000 by plugging in the SK-1100 keyboard and the SR-1000 tape recorder and, you know, basically hodgepodge yourself together a functional computer. So, you know, the idea was like, Is there a real distinction between computers and consoles, aside from the fact that consoles are going to be more affordable? There was this kind of blurred line between the two formats. And I think really the fallout from the systems that launched in 1983 from Sega and Nintendo is that the lines did become more clearly demarcated after a couple of years. Like, you know, they got that kind of computer thing out of their system and said, you know what? Actually, this is just better for playing video games. So let's just do that and let the computer people do their computer thing. But it was still very nebulous and sort of up in the air in 1983.
I think it worked out a little bit for them in Japan because they didn't have the computer price war we did in the US, because that was really undermining a lot of these computer expansions. Like, you know, Atari was talking about putting one out for the 2600, and then after seeing, you know, the low end of the market just completely collapse, they realized it was not financially viable and just sort of canned the whole thing.
I think that the game capability was both of these machines was both like by design, in that the people who were selling them realized that this was one easy way to get computers into the house, into the household, and that this was like probably the flashiest thing you could get a computer to do to get somebody's attention. But they were also running on very, very similar hardware. In a lot of cases, there wasn't a huge distinction, as you were saying, Jeremy, about like what the capabilities were of these different machines. Like they were all, you look at like the, what, which processors, you know, microcomputers Z80, were using.
6502, yeah. 8800. Or 88,
yeah.
8800, yeah.
Yeah, the Motorola, yeah, you've got the MOS 6502 and the Zilog Z80. And it's just like, it's in, going all the way back to the 70s. So and in a lot of cases, these things, while we didn't have any kind of one home computer system that caught on in the United States, what was really big at the time was like adapters that could make things interoperable, whether the manufacturers wanted them or not, you know?
Well, and, you know, to kind of further blur the lines, if you look inside under the hood of the ColecoVision, the SC-1000, and the MSX, they're almost exactly the same, except the MSX had, like, a little more RAM, and otherwise, they're basically the same thing, but, like, which is a computer, which is a console, they all kind of straddled that line, all three of those systems. But Kevin, you mentioned the pricing wars on computers in the bottom end in the US. I know we've probably talked about that on Retronauts before, but for the context of this episode, could you give a little more detail on that? and sure. what Commodore did to scuttle everyone's dreams and hopes.
Yeah, so Commodore, they had bought MosTec, which made 6502. They basically controlled their own production line at this point. And they had gotten screwed over by Texas Instruments, conducting a price war against them with, I believe it was calculators, some years earlier. And they decided that they were going to get back at them. So they put out the VIC-20 in, I think, 81, 82. I forget exactly what year. But that was reasonably successful. That was like a low-end computer. And they talked about introducing the Commodore 64, which was going to be their like mid-range machine. Texas Instruments was putting out the TI-99-4A. That was going to be their upgrade from the previous TI-99 computer, and which, to a point earlier, was not interoperable with the older computer at all. And so the two of them kind of got into a price war because, again, Commodore controlled their own production line. They could set their own prices as they wanted, so they just kept cutting the price of the VIC-20 and the Commodore 64 over and over, and they forced TI to do the same thing. And this happened basically through the whole of 83. And they succeeded in pushing TI out of the computer market entirely, the consumer market. They also succeeded in pushing out pretty much everyone else who could not keep up with this price war the two of them were having. So like we talk about all these standards that were in the U.S., but by I believe 1985, it was basically only Commodore and Atari left in the game. Just like everything else got destroyed. And there were plans to introduce, I think, the ZX Spectrum and some of these NEC Japanese computers in the U.S., and they just took one look at what was going on and threw up their hands, decided it was not going to work out.
So yeah,
I was just going to say, I think Apple also managed to stick around for quite a while, but they sort of did their own weird thing and dug themselves an early grave with some of their choices.
Yeah, Apple, they kind of decided to stick around in their own particular price bracket. They were like the high end along with the IBM PC, and as a result, they got to just sort of ignore this whole price war, and everyone let them do it.
They also had the advantage of educational hooks, so they, were more affordable, but only for schools and educators. So they had that whole ecosystem kind of locked down for almost a decade. So that gave them a lot of extra traction and durability too. Anyway, Rob, you were saying?
Yeah, I was gonna say like that. I think you guys described kind of the conundrum facing people at that time, because nobody was ready to entirely give up, but everybody was in sort of a wait and see stage. And I mean, yeah, it's interesting that Apple's kind of modern day philosophy didn't really change much, from that time period to now, but it just became a lot more successful in a different way. But yeah, they were very much like, no, we're going to sell things for a price that's profitable considering how much it costs to build them. And yeah, I mean, that didn't help them for a long time, but now nobody cares. So the idea of, to me, like the MSX kind of presented the skeleton key for sort of understanding this time period specifically for Japan, because it's kind of got its roots in just everything. And it shows you just how interconnected the technology world was, even though every market kind of had its own dominant players. So I don't know if you want to go into that now or.
Yeah, let's transition into that in a few minutes. Before we get there, I do want to say that I'm very grateful to organizations like Gaming Alexandria and Video Game History Foundation and everyone else, archive.org, who has helped really sort of curate and preserve media from this period. Firsthand, basically accounts of what was happening in the games industry with trade publications like Computer Entertainer, and what's the other one that you linked to, Kevin? The
Weekly Television Digest with Consumer Electronics.
Yes. So having access to these old publications that were largely forgotten for many, many years, having those surface and available is really useful, because you can look and say, what were people actually saying about the state of the industry at this time? What were they saying about, things that were coming out? And the two publications that I mentioned, are great because they offer very different perspectives. Like Computer Entertainer Video Game Update is very much enthusiast media before there was such a thing. Like they are, whoever was editing the publication, and it's not credited for whatever reason, it's just like mystery names. They were really clearly passionate about video games and loved the medium. And, you know, it kind of feels almost like a fanzine that sort of, you know, because it was there before fanzines, they got access and, you know, had direct connections to the industry. And the industry was a lot smaller. There weren't as many PR gateways and barriers at the time. So, you know, they're covering video games from the perspective of like, hey, we really want great video games, but we're also frustrated by things that are happening. And here's what the companies are saying. And, you know, also, here are reviews of games that the companies have provided for us. And we're able to, you know, cover what's contemporary. So you get that perspective of kind of the enthusiast media. And then you have the Television Digest, which is very, very dispassionate, very much about, it's like, you know, bullet points. Like you could almost send these articles by telegram because they're so concise and very dry and just straightforward. But there were still editorial decisions being made about what to cover and what to talk about. And one thing that I thought was really interesting is going through 1983's Television Digests, I didn't see a single mention of Nintendo aside from like they might release some new arcade games next year. And likewise, Sega basically got a mention saying, hey, there's, you know, some new Sega games possibly coming to ColecoVision, but you're not going to see Star Trek because of licensing complications. And that was it. So these companies... go ahead.
I was going to say, I found one blurb about Nintendo in June where they mentioned that the price war might be coming to Japan because Nintendo is releasing their own family computer and Casio is putting out a computer and Epoch is putting out a junior computer. So, and all of these are causing Commodore to slash the price of their Max machine that they were selling pretty much only in Japan. And other than that, that's it. That's the only reference I found in there to the Famicom.
Okay, so there is... I didn't look back that far. I started in July because I figured anything would, you know, news-wise would sort of trickle out after that. But that is interesting because what I do find is that when you see Japanese companies mentioned in Television Digest, it's always in the sense of, you know, the sort of market protectionism that was really, really being rallied around in the 80s as American industry was terrified of Japan eating its lunch. So you get a lot of numbers on stats of how many televisions are being manufactured by Japanese companies or how many VCRs. Like that was a really big one. How many VCRs were coming from Japan? But when it comes to actually covering the game consoles, there's just no awareness of the Famicom or the SG-1000. The MSX gets a mention in December, just kind of in a general sort of like, hey, this might be coming to the US next year, which apparently it didn't. But, you know, that's pretty much it. And it's very much, you know, kind of focused around the American market. So it actually tracks that the one mention that you did see of the Famicom in 1983 was very much in the sense of like, hey, this is going to hurt an American company because they are exporting systems to Japan and now they're going to face pricing pressure. So it kind of, I think it does a really good job of sort of showing you where American industry and media was at the time, just kind of from the dispassionate big picture type stuff.
Yeah.
But then you look go ahead.
I was going to say, yeah. And at the time, like, I think the part of that was also not just like Japan's like emerging economic power, but Japan was getting in trouble for like illegally subsidizing some of their industries and things like that in ways that I think were not permitted by the trade agreements that they had. That was what was happening at this time too. And people were actually already used to seeing Japanese businesses kind of upend different markets. They were beginning to, just in 1983, probably was just beginning to eat American car manufacturers' lunch. But they had like kind of messed with the motorcycle market in the 60s, going that far back with like Hondas. Like the Beach Boys wrote a song about like a super cheap Honda motorbike that was like, you know, people were upset about things like that too.
Oh yeah, I remember that episode of Mad Men.
First gear, it's all right. Second gear, a lean fast. Third gear,
Yeah, there were also, you know, there's plenty of mentions for years of Weekly Television Digest where they're talking about, like, the legal arguments over Japan dumping televisions off in the U.S. super cheap that they, you know, didn't want to try and sell domestically. So, yeah, I can understand where they were coming from. And if you go late enough in the magazine, they start listing the exchange rate of U.S. dollars and yen just in every single edition. So it's a fun, like, tracking, because they realized at that point, well, okay, Japan's here to stay. There's nothing we can really do to stop that. So for folks who want to deal in Japanese business, you'll probably want this information.
Yeah, well, that was also around the time that the yen was uncoupled from the dollar after World War II. So I think that happened in like 84, 85. So there were wild fluctuations in pricing around this time. Like, just, you know, the whole thing turned upside down when all of a sudden the dollar could buy so many fewer yen.
Yeah, I don't know whether people were even prepared for Japan to enter the computer space, because it was such a young market in the United States as well. So I don't know whether anybody anticipated anything other than just price competition from them. And it's like, oh, it's bad now, it's going to get worse.
And yeah, exporting and importing, they were much more complex at the time and cost a lot more. So, you know, the cost of shipping and freight and localization, it was slower and more onerous. So yeah, I do think that was still kind of a foreign concept, literally. But yeah, I don't know. Everything was so hyper-regional and hyper-specific to different countries. And really, it kind of seems like around this time, it was mostly American companies on the computer front were the ones exporting computers and consoles and not really importing. But, you know, there was sort of the inflow of Japanese games, arcade games, coming into the U.S. and into Europe through different distribution networks. And so there was kind of that foot in the door, I think. But, you know, a standalone, self-contained, one-off arcade unit is different than an entire computer platform or an entire console, because those are ecosystems. So, yeah, I don't know. I think it's interesting to look back and just see, though, how little the Famicom registered and the SG-1000 registered for nearly a year. It wasn't until, you know, they started making rumblings about localizing the Famicom into the US as the AVS and the NES that you really started to see coverage. But, you know, looking at Computer Entertainer, they were also not aware of the SG-1000 or Famicom in 1983, though, again, you get comments about Sega releases for ColecoVision. But what you do see in the Computer Entertainer magazine, actually, at this point, it was Video Game Update featuring Computer Entertainer and was really focused on console games, you know, after started in the 2600 era in television and really covered consoles. And then the computer games were the back section. But there's a lot of kind of grumbling and heartache about the fact that, yes, there are still video games coming out, but a lot of these platforms seem to have dried up. And there seems to be a lot of broken promises and a lot of uncertainty about things that have been pitched to us and sold to us and now don't seem to be happening. And I think the following year, the publication kind of reversed the focus and became Computer Entertainer featuring Video Game Update as opposed to vice versa, which just kind of shows how quickly the video game market, the console game market in the US collapsed.
Yeah, 83 was not a banner year for the American console market at all, you know. Based on the reporting from these outlets and, you know, a couple others that I've come across, you know, basically everyone was laying people off or they were closing. Atari had a ton of layoffs. Mattel laid off massive numbers of people because, you know, the Intellivision was just not selling anymore and they were losing gobs of money. Coleco was actually doing kind of okay. They announced that their revenues were up, even if profits were down in the summer. So they were therefore going to keep pushing ahead with their Atom computer release when everyone else was not doing that. Maybe they should have followed suit, given how that worked out for them, but I can understand why they had the hubris.
Yeah, there's always money in the cabbage patch, you know what I'm saying?
Yeah, exactly. But, you know, you had the computer price war, which you've already touched on. Commodore was basically undercutting literally everybody else. A lot of these console third parties, Activision, Imagic, Parker Brothers, CBS, Electronics, they were moving their resources away from consoles ever so slightly into the computer market because they saw that as sort of a safe haven, and it was being hyped up by a lot of these companies as the next big fad for consumer electronics. It never quite reached the expectations anyone had for it, so a lot of these companies ended up losing money there as well, but they sure tried.
Is Commodore's like dominance, do we credit Jack Tramiel with that, or is that not? Had he already left?
He was still there, I believe, through the start of the price war. I think he left in late 83, early 84. I don't remember the specific timing. But yeah, he was around for part of it. I'm pretty sure this does have his fingerprints on it. This is his kind of activity.
Yeah, just sort of general nastiness.
Yeah. There were some like neat things going on in the console space in the US. Like this was the summer of the Game Line service that started up in Chicago from Control Video Corporation. And the idea was that you could plug this adapter into your 2600 and download a game through your phone line. It's sort of the same basic idea as what the Play Cable did for the Intellivision, only that used like a cable line, and this was a standard telephone, which probably made a lot more sense because not many people had cable TV in 1983. And they had like a lot of games. They had some 100-odd games. Some of them were from companies that had gone under, and some were from companies that were still around that were major players. Like, I think CBS was in there, among a few others. But yeah, there were some releases that were really good, and some of these are really sort of well-known now, like Jungle Hunt for the 2600, all of the Qbert home ports. People really like those. Burger Time on the Intellivision. Some like unique original games like Moonsweeper from Imagic, Dreadnought Factor, and Beam Rider from Activision. Like, these were all really cool games that came out. They were just in a position where you'd get full price sales for like a couple of weeks, and then you'd have to start slashing the price, or else everyone's going to just go buy what's being cleared out for pennies on the dollar. It's not a great time for businesses. Great time if you're a consumer.
Yeah, something else worth mentioning is that the American economy was kind of in the crapper at this point. You know, we had just come off the back of the 70s with massive inflation and the oil crisis and just general horribleness, just a brutal, brutal time for the American economy. And people were really, you know, they had kind of learned to pull their belt a little tighter. And things started to kind of look better at the beginning of the 80s. And then there was another recession that hit right around this time. And that also affected the European market a lot. So one of the advantages I think that the Japanese market had, Japanese companies, is that Japan was experiencing the so-called economic miracle. And just, you know, they were going up, 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 while everyone else was going up, down, up, down, 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 up, down. So there was a lot more money being thrown around in the market, a lot more consumer flexibility, a lot more discretionary spending, and people just saying, hey, you know, I got cash. I can spend $100 on a single videotape that's 30 minutes. Why not? It's, you know, money is just infinite. It's fun. It's free. It'll just keep coming forever.
And this tape is well animated. Come on.
Yes, exactly.
Yeah, I think like the bubble technically starts in 1986, but I don't understand enough about economics to know what actually caused it exactly. But I do know that they were definitely on the upswing when most countries were not. Mm-hmm. And that, if nothing else, affected consumer confidence.
Yeah, my understanding is that the so-called bubble, yeah, that was later, kind of like the late 80s, basically. But the so-called economic miracle, which isn't quite the same thing, is basically kind of the, you know, sort of the post-World War II era, starting in the late 60s, 70s. And it wasn't just a like straight upward arc for Japan, but, you know, coming from basically a company that was demolished and destitute in the 1950s to what it had been, you know, had become by the end of the 70s, was really remarkable. And, you know, putting aside, irrespective of all the consumerism, trade complaints and things like that, just the fact that the company had, or the company, God, the country had turned itself around so effectively and was in such great shape, and just constantly seemed to be on the upward climb. That was remarkable and, you know, pretty alarming to other countries where things weren't necessarily that way. But just, you know, internally, in terms of making video games and cool, fun things like that, it was a very fertile time. People worked hard and spent long hours doing what they did. And, you know, there was a lot of cultural expectations for how people would spend their time and spend their money. But in their free time, when they did have it, they had a lot of options, and video games really rushed in to sort of fill that vacuum.
And this was after, you know, there were shifts in how the coin-op industry regulated itself at this point in Japan. And I don't remember if there were actual laws in place by this point, but there was definitely fertile ground for more home games, because at this mm-hmm. point, children weren't really being allowed into arcade spaces unless they were accompanied by an adult.
Yeah, I believe. Well, that, I think it was. I've read a few different things, but the best explanation I've seen has come from Matt Alt, and I don't remember exactly where he wrote about it. But there were laws passed, I think, in 1984 that really limited the amount of time kids could spend in arcades after hours. It was like after 6 p.m. or something. It was pretty much an adult-only space, you know, unless kids were accompanied by adults.
Right.
So it was, you know, the idea was to kind of reduce delinquency after hours and keep kids out of arcades. So it did change the makeup of the kind of games you saw in arcades. You started to see, I covered this in a recent video, you started to see a lot more like adult-oriented games show up in arcades because, you know, kids couldn't go. So the arcade operators had to cater to someone. So why not dudes who got off their 12, 14 hour work shifts and were kind of horny and lonely have some strip mahjong games? Why not? but yes, it also really, it was a great boon for everyone making home consoles, because if kids couldn't play video games at the arcade, they still wanted to play video games. So obviously they had to play it at home. So that was a great opening, you know, kind of an opportunity for console makers,
yeah,
and computer makers. But, you know, at the time, Japanese home computers, aside from like the kind of low end stuff like MSX and SG-1 or SC-3000, were very expensive, even by Japanese standards, you know, with a booming economy, still not cheap, not necessarily the kids' kind of platform.
Yeah, I know in 79 is when the Japanese entertainment, like amusement industry, passed their own like internal rules that said that, okay, kids can't go playing around in these places because they were afraid the government would regulate them during the invader boom. Mm-hmm. And clearly those, you know, self-imposed regulations only had so many teeth if the government went ahead and did that in 1984 anyway. But that was a boon to those console makers, and there was also a few things going on in Japan that were handy for those making coin-op games too. Like in December 1982, this lawsuit that started during the invader boom about you know, are video games protectable under copyright law? December 82 is when that finally got ruled on, and they said yes, you know, video games are like books or whatever else, you have copyright protections, and that really allowed the Japanese government and all of these, you know, companies making these games to start cracking down on bootlegs. And, you know, there's only so much you can do about bootlegging, but it was a big help for them in Japan at the time.
But it didn't crack down on like every Space Invaders clone ever. Those were all still legit and you could do those.
Yeah. I mean, if they were already on the market, what are you going to do about it?
Yeah. And, you know, there have been arguments that the Invaders clones actually, the Taito kind of looked at them and said, yeah, that's okay, because we actually can't manufacture enough games to meet demand. Kind of like Atari, you know, like this is just building enthusiasm for our product.
Oh, they actually licensed a few different companies to make clones legally for them, and then they turned around and like went after the ones who weren't making legal clones. So that was an interesting thing to learn. Like, as you said, they couldn't keep up with demand. I don't think the Japanese coin-op industry ever hit those same highs as the Invader boom, but they were doing all right in the early 80s.
Yeah, so to kind of understand the Japanese market at this point, you have arcade games, which, you know, were kind of being limited in terms of access for kids. You had a very, very healthy computer market with several sort of locally grown home computer platforms where there was a pretty good audience there, and lots of people were making games for these systems. There were a few import systems like Apple II, VIC-20, C64, that really were kind of limited in their reach, very expensive because of their import nature, but proved to be very fertile ground for some very influential programmers and designers down the road. You also had, you know, this kind of underserved console space. And that was, I think, you know, the Japanese console space just hadn't quite found its hit yet. And that was an opportunity where Famicom and SG-1000 could really thrive, because by 1983, you'd seen, you know, like I mentioned before, the import systems like Intellivision and Arcadia, but these were very expensive by the standards of console games at the time. You had Epoch in 1981 release the Cassette Vision, which was priced much lower than import systems. But it was also much less capable. It was really just, you know, an LSI Pong game, you know, or baseball game, like a standalone self-contained system from the 70s that just happened to be in console form. And it's a kind of complicated thing to explain, but it wasn't up to the standards of, you know, the ColecoVision or the Intellivision. It was much more primitive and it did pretty well for itself, but Epoch, their internal development systems, you know, their bandwidth was very constrained. So they could only publish like one game every 3 months because they just had such few technical resources to work with. So it wasn't exactly a thriving platform. And a lot of the games that they released, especially early on for the Cassette Vision, were literally just reworkings of their standalone devices from the 70s. I mean, their baseball game was actually just their standalone baseball console from 1977 on a cartridge at the end of 1981 or early 82. So that's kind of cool, but also very limited. And, you know, compared to what was happening in arcades at the time, like compare, you know, a 1977 LSI or TTL baseball game to something like Pole Position or, you know, Popeye or whatever. And it's very disappointing, I think.
Yeah, they were really pushing against those constraints on that Cassette Vision, like hardware, by this point too. Cause, you mentioned in the notes that they had one game that came out this summer and that was Astro Command. And that's for the Cassette Vision, a pretty advanced little game. It's like a scramble type clone.
It's wild that they were able to do that with that hardware, but it's rough. It's really rough.
Mm-hmm. Then you look at that, and then you look at, you know, Zevius, and you're like, oh, wow, what's going on here? what are we doing, Epoch?
Exactly. So in 1983, you have Epoch rework the Cassette Vision into the Cassette Vision Junior, which is a weird little console. It's not a new console. It doesn't offer new capabilities. It's actually less capable than the previous one. It's just very cheap. It makes the CassetteVision library accessible for less money, but also it limits some of the games you can play because it doesn't have the rotary dials of the original CassetteVision. It doesn't have the expansion adapter that you could plug a light gun into. And the light gun was barely used on CassetteVision. It was just for like four events in a 12-event sports cartridge. But still, you couldn't play it on CassetteVision Junior. But it does kind of create this weird sort of split in the hardware and software family, because the games released up to the CassetteVision Junior are really kind of built around the rotary dials and the very sort of linear switches. But then after that, the CassetteVision Junior is structured, you know, the control inputs. It doesn't have the rotary dials, and it has a cross-shaped input for its buttons. So you start getting more traditional, you know, like the arcade games of the 80s type things with elevator action type clones and Donkey Kong type games. And of course, a Pac-Man type game that was very, very popular. And those are
Pac-Pac Monster. Is that it?
Yes, Pac-Pac Monster. That's right. That game is horrible, horrible to play on the original CassetteVision, because you're trying to move in four cardinal directions, but the buttons you use are laid out side by side. So it's like, it's, you know, like what if you were trying to play a first person shooter, but the WASD controls were just like ASDF instead. Just, it sucks.
Yeah, that's a good comparison.
But, you know, it's possible, but it's just not fun. But the thing is, you know, you can't play the older games really on CassetteVision Junior. You can't play the newer games on the original CassetteVision. So it kind of splits the market, what little market existed for it.
Yeah, it's interesting. If you look at the games they had for this, you know, they were all like, as you said, they're kind of like knockoffs, essentially. But it gives you an idea of what the first console makers in Japan felt like they had to have, right? You have to have a Pac-Man game. You've got a Monster Mansion inspired by Donkey Kong.
You've got Yosaku, which is just straight up stealing Kikori Yosaku by SNK. Like, it's not even apologetic, and I can't find any evidence that it was licensed. It was just straight up ripping off the game concept and the name. Amazing.
Its light gun looks like it's just like a World War One like Mauser or something.
It is a Mauser. It is literally a yeah. Mauser. I'm going to take one up to Long Island Retro Expo later in August. And I'm kind of worried about traveling with it because, like, it looks like a real gun that just happens to have a cable coming out of it. I mean, you hold it, you're obviously, this is obviously not a real Mauser, but, you know, I'm going to put that in my suitcase and TSA is going to be like, hey, buddy, we need to have a talk about this. I'm checking for sure.
It's black. It's got a brown wood colored handle, just like the real antique firearm.
No, like Indiana Jones is going to steal that and shoot some Nazis with it.
Or Han Solo for that matter, because it's also the gun they used to make Han Solo's gun. Yeah,
just wrap some orange tape around the end of the barrel. They're like, look, see, it's a toy.
Yeah, that worked until people started 3D printing their own handguns to look like Lego blocks. So
It would be nice to live in a country where if a kid had like a mouse, everybody like, oh, cool, he's got a cassette vision.
Oh, that's so cute. Yeah. Nope.
Isn't that nice? You don't have to worry about it because you know that
a horrible place
gun.
Instead.
Yeah. Anyway. Sorry. I didn't. That's no, really no, not no, adding totally much. Fine. But when you look at those games, right, like that's what they had to do. That's like that's the baseline. And it's funny that when the Famicom comes out later, it's like, it's the same stuff, you know, essentially. They don't even have Pac-Man right away. Right. So.
But you get Mahjong.
They do have Mahjong. Pac-Man came, I think December of 84. And that was really kind of once Namco strong armed its way into the market and said, hey, we're going to make some games for your system. So this is what's happening. And Nintendo, I guess, said, that's fine. You and Hudson, go for it.
It's also interesting because at this point, console games in the United States were definitely a thing, like an idea of a game that is made for consoles, right?
Oh, yeah.
It's made to play at home. And that was developing on its own. But then the development kind of gets cut short and it starts over because the next console boom comes from Japan. And they're originally starting out with just arcade conversions or ripoffs. And then they end up reaching the same conclusion that the people like Activision did and said, oh, we can make this more replayable. But, you know, history is not always a straight line for these things. So.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
It's a horrible wibbly wobbly thing, apparently. I think that's the term. Yeah, so you have the cassette vision. You have some other consoles that were just kind of fading out. You have the Tomiputa Jr., which I mentioned before was the Tomy Tutor, basically, but consoleized, but could play all the games. Didn't really need to be a computer in the first place, really. But it's hard to get a real read on the exact timeline of releases for the Tomiputa, but it seems like it was basically coming to an end in 1983. So it just, you know, they released like 26 games over the course of a year and a half or so. And the cool thing, like the most interesting thing so far that I've seen about the Tomiputa is that one of the final games for the system, Baseball 3D, the cover art is the first piece of art I can find by the guy who does the Famitsu covers, you know, the Ghost and Goblins guy or the Maximo guy.
Yeah.
Susumu Matsushita, is that his name?
I'm also blanking, but Famitsu guy is pretty iconic.
Susumu, yeah, you got it right, Jeremy. Susumu Matsushita.
Matsushita, okay, yeah. Yeah, like I've seen, you know, the box art for Sega's SG-1000 card games, and they look very Matsushita-ish, but they're not quite right. But this one, like this baseball piece, is straight up his style, and it's got his signature at the bottom, and it's from 1983. So he was actually active in, you know, cover art and working in video games longer than I've seen credited for him on the internet. Like, you know, people trace his work back to the beginning of Famitsu in 1986, but he was out there doing stuff. So that's kind of cool for people who give a crap about box art, which, you know, not a lot of people do, but I do, and I'm happy about discovering that. Anyway, so yeah, I don't think the Tomiputa Jr. moved the needle at all. And there would be some consoles launch in Japan in late 83 that would just absolutely bomb. And we can talk about those on some other episode. But in July, you really have three major players. You have Nintendo, Sega, and other being everyone involved in the MSX platform standard. So maybe we should explain that first, because Rob, I know you wanted to talk about MSX. It's why you're here, really. So before we get into the known, let's talk about the unknown. What the hell is going on with this MSX thing anyway? It's basically an SG-1000, right? But fancier.
Yeah, I mean, it's also basically possibly a ColecoVision. That's the weird thing I found out about it when I was looking into it. Because I did some research on this last time. I think I was on the show was for the Konami MSX like kind of catalog. And I gave some information about how I think I said that the MSX was probably announced, not necessarily released, but announced in around June, I think, 1983. It might have been earlier, though. And it's funny that you talked about the bring up Famitsu and how like the artist there was already working in video games, because I get the impression that this was a very incestuous community between like tech magazines and the home computer like hobby scene and early software publishers. They probably all ran in pretty similar circles. And it definitely seems like if you were sort of, you know, it had its share of like, it just like, you know, the 70s in the United States and in Northern California had its kind of cast of characters, right? I think there was a similar thing going on in Japan, just that history isn't as well documented in English. So I don't know that much. Mm. But I do know that the founder of, for NES or like Japanese console fans know the ASCII Corporation, right? Mm-hmm. Not the ASCII text standard, but it started out as a magazine. And it was this guy named Kazuhiko Nishi. And he was one of these visionary types who early on in like as the microcomputer stuff was first starting to happen in Japan, like the first generations of that. And as it was kind of growing out of the hobby scene, which at the time being a microcomputer fan was a lot like being a model train enthusiast. And in Hudson Soft's case, it was the same.
Yeah, literally the same thing.
But Japan is a very like hobby focused culture. And I think it has been for a while. At least it was at the time. And I think it still is today. And you can tell because they have a magazine culture that still survives to this day. And a lot of them are based around like enthusiasms, I guess, things that you're a fan of. And ASCII was this, you know, was kind of, Nishi was using his magazine to kind of get his foot in the door of all kinds of other things. So in the 70s, apparently he just called up Microsoft, probably when Microsoft was maybe like 15 people or something, but he just called, hey, can I talk to Bill Gates? And Bill Gates took the call and they just talked about, and I don't know how much they could have understood, but Nishi apparently allegedly ended up saying like, hey, why don't I, I'll buy your ticket. I'll fly you out to Japan. Let me show you. I think we can do something here. I think Microsoft can find a new market here. And that didn't end up happening, but they did end up meeting a little bit later. And ASCII ended up being, I think, I don't know if it was Microsoft's only publisher in Japan, but it was one of its major publishers for their software for all these different platforms in this like platform sort of wilderness that was existing even in Japan at the time. But moving ahead to like 1982, where the ColecoVision is starting to be developed, that's where a kind of hardware standard starts to take shape, but not necessarily intentionally. And Nishi's idea at the time was, forget about, we don't need IBM to come up with its own computer and Radio Shack to sell its own computer and you know, Sharp to have its own computer. What we need is a standard and everybody can produce their machines that fit that standard. And then everybody can create software for it. And we'll finally have like a nice, robust software library, something really healthy. Like I imagine that people in Japan must have been looking at the Apple II at the time kind of enviously, because that scene was developing as a software scene. And it was probably hard to do that on, say, like the FM7 or something like that. And so Nishi really believed in this, and but he wasn't the only one. A lot of people had the same idea. And one of the reasons why is, as we were talking about, although the console and microcomputer markets were very much like split up and balkanized, the tech they ran on was almost always the same cluster of stuff. The people who were making these chips and VDPs and everything, Benj Edwards, if he were here, could probably do a much better job of explaining it. But it was a lot more international cooperation on that front because their supply chains were all mixed up. Unless I guess you were Commodore, in which case you could just do whatever you wanted. But so he came up with this idea, or rather, he was friends with a guy named Harry Fox, who I think was a watchmaker originally. But he founded this company called SpectraVision. And SpectraVision is not, if you're from the 80s, you might remember like Hotel Pay-Per-View. They got sued by that SpectraVision and changed their name to Spectra Video. So I'm going to probably just refer to them as Spectra, but they created this company and they did a few things. They created, I believe, the first, or what's said to be the first ergonomic controller for the Atari 2600, the QuickShot. I think they published Chase the Chuck Wagon and the weirdest Atari game I've ever seen, which is Manja. Yeah, have you heard about this?
They published quite a few weird games for the 2600. That one is particularly weird. That's the one where you play a kid and your mother keeps bringing you food and you have to like surreptitiously get rid of it when she's not looking, or else you'll eat too much and explode.
You explode. It is horrifying. Like, it is a really, there were some really scary games back then. So Harry Fox came up with this idea for a microcomputer based on Zilog's, is it Zilog or Zilog? I don't know, actually.
I think it's Zilog. I have no idea.
Yeah. The Z80 processor, which is, as Jeremy has said, is, it was very much already a popular chip. So his idea was Z80 processor, the Texas Instrument TMS, the chip I see is TMS9918, video display processor, and I think maybe a Yamaha sound chip, or maybe the sound chip was an afterthought. I'm not sure. But his goal at the time was he wanted to make a computer that would cost $30 to make in 1982, $83, and could be sold for $100. So that's like saying it would cost $100 to make today in 2023 and sell for about $320. That's a very cheap. That's cheaper than any like game console.
It is, but that's also really good margins on hardware. Like anyone who makes hardware now would be drooling over those margins. 70%. Well, people, wow.
Yeah, people did, and it never happened because it was impossible. But
that would explain it.
So Spectre Vision shows this to ASCII's Kazuhiko Nishi, and Nishi looks at this and he's like, "Oh wait, no, this is pretty good actually." And it sounds like and keep in mind, I'm getting some of my information from like translated Japanese sources, so I'm trying to get this all right. But if I make a mistake, you know, forgive me. But it sounds to me like what he did was Nishi kind of realized that this hardware spec that Harry Fox came up with could actually be turned into a really versatile configuration that could do a wide range of tasks, especially like musical features and graphical features that IBM's kind of emerging slow moving juggernaut wouldn't be able to handle. And they didn't, you know, I think a lot of people at this time period in the software business didn't really want IBM to emerge as the major player because they felt like they would be better off just, you know, it should be like it was in the 70s where everybody's working on the same kinds of hardware and the same, you know, that's what they wanted. But in order to do that, he would probably have to make improve the specs and things like that. At the same time, though, the Connecticut Leather Company hired Coleco, I guess it's Coleco technically.
It's Coleco. I mean, it comes from the word leather, but it's pronounced Coleco.
It sounds better as Coleco, doesn't it?
It does. It really does.
It rolls off the tongue.
Yeah. So they hired a former Midway guy named Eric Brumley to create a game console / microcomputer, and that was what became the ColecoVision. And Brumley's design relied on a Z80 and a Texas Instruments VDP, and it was similar enough to the Spectra specs that Spectra Vision, which I think at that point was now Spectra Video, could release an adapter for one of their microcomputers that could just play ColecoVision games. So that's kind of what I was talking about. That was fairly common back then. But since both Spectra Video and ColecoVision, this is the rumor part, where they shared some business partners in Hong Kong. There's been some speculation that somebody stole something from someone. So I'll defer to whatever Benj Edwards later says about this, if he knows. But that's what I've
heard. I don't think anything is firmly established there. And, you know, to further muddy the waters, this spec is exactly the same as the SG-1000, SC-3000, and Othello Multivision, which, you know, there are some rumors on the internet that Sega was going to release the SG-1000 in 1981, that there was like a test market done, but there's not really any hard evidence for that. So, you know, it's really hard to kind of winnow through and see what really happened, what was really the case here. And even, you know, I reached out to Sega to kind of figure out some of the details here, get a straight story. And what I was told was, well, you know, no one here was actually on hand working on that platform at the time of its launch, so we can't actually answer this question for you. We don't know. So that's one cool dead end for you.
A likely story, Sega.
And the people who did this stuff would not have said anything about it necessarily, because a lot, like if you think that there's not somebody at Nintendo at the time who had a very good knowledge of like the Commodore 64 and other platforms, you would be kidding yourself. Everybody's doing this. This is what.
Oh no, they had Satoru Iwata, who knew the VIC-20 and 6502 other platforms inside and out, but he was at HAL, not at Nintendo. Gosh, get it straight.
Yeah, well, I mean, I'm just saying, like, there were definitely people who knew these things inside and out. Mm-hmm. That was how, you know, IBM gets its dominance bird-dogged, essentially, because people, like, reverse engineer their stuff. And people could do that back then pretty fairly easily. But anyway, you can see how this happens, because it ends up kind of biting Harry Fox in a way very quickly. So as I was saying, what Nishi did when he looked at the spec and he's like, okay, I'm going to beef this up, make it more versatile, give it some AV capability. So it could be more of a home computer, something that would have multiple uses, not just like balancing your checkbook or whatever. And I think he added more RAM. And I think one of the things he did is he kind of future-proofed it in a way so that he had an idea that floppy drives would be a thing pretty soon. And so he kind of built that expectation into the design. I think he may have changed the keyboard design possibly to make it work better with Japanese. I don't know. Maybe not. But his idea was just, I can make this, if we make this more expensive slightly and take a bigger cut in the profit margin, this could be everybody's standard. This could be something that you could plan devices around and around anticipated advances in price drops that people kind of saw coming in like the next 5 years. So like, if we can get a computer that lasts people for 5 years, they won't be so upset when they have to upgrade because they won't have to upgrade everything. They can kind of do it piecemeal. So if there's a new media format, if people are using diskettes in 1985, well, we can sell a disk drive for this, right? Or whatever the case may have ended up being. And gaming was definitely, I think, part of the reason for some of his changes, even if it's not based on the ColecoVision, because I think Nishi's idea was to use this hardware to, as we said, like kind of get this thing into people's homes. And you need to show like, here's like educational uses and like a drawing program and things like that. So that might have been what he was up to. But a lot of this is just kind of speculation from a few different people. Nishi takes this spec and shows it to everybody. He's also showing it to Microsoft, who, as we know, he has a close working relationship with. And he's thinking, because right now Microsoft is, at this point, it has just been getting into the OS market. So IBM has tapped them to create a disk operating system, an OS. They buy somebody else's QDOS and turn it into PC DOS. And Nishi's thought, well, we could create a Microsoft OS for this, and we have a hardware standard, and now we've got a platform. And all of Japan's manufacturers, he showed this to everybody. And like, it's just a list of names. It's like everybody but the people who are already working on their own thing, I think. And but at the same time he was doing that and showing it off, Harry Fox and the people at Spectra were kind of doing their own thing, and they took Nishi's concept and changed almost nothing and sold it as the Spectra Video 318 computer. And this computer has, if you look at its like the original keyboard for the original design, it's just like the MSX keyboard. It's got the built-in joystick. It's got all that stuff. So then later on, probably in late, I'm guessing late 82 or early 83 is probably when this happened. I'm going to say early 83. Nishi calls Harry Fox up again and says, hey, every company in Japan wants to license your Spectravision as a platform. But Harry Fox doesn't want to give them the Spectravideo 318. And the thought is that he probably said, hey, look, I ripped off your design, dude. Like, I don't want to have to say that. I don't want you, if it has to be licensed from Spectra, people are going to find out where this came from. So he was worried that either Nishi or Coleco or somebody would realize something was up. And so he said, look, what you do is you change the specs a little bit, release it as your own standard, and just make it so you don't change it too much. And that way Spectra can sell an adapter to make its computers cross compatible. And so that's where the MSX came from. That's it. That's what it is. It's a Spectravideo 318 with a few minor tweaks for legal reasons. Kevin, I think looks like there's a note from you in here if you want to.
Yeah, so the MSX, it did pretty well for itself in Japan, I think, is sort of where we're going with this. I don't know how well it did in 83, because the timeline's a little nebulous there. But you know, it shipped out into various countries in like Europe and the Middle East, and found a pretty good market in all of these different parts of the world, except sort of the U.S. There was a lot of talk, if you look at the trade periodicals from like 84, 85, about bringing the MSX standard just fully into the U.S., just beyond like this Spectravideo thing. And it just never really materializes, because by that point, the computer market in the U.S. has already sort of coalesced around a standard of the Commodore 64 and the Atari 800, at least on the mid-range. So I think that's probably why it never quite pans out, but there is definitely interest, especially from retailers and distributors and the software makers.
Probably because there was really no, like, it wasn't like there was a standard in North America that was being followed. It was still like a bifurcated microcomputer market where you, if you got a Commodore, you were going to use Commodore software. You were going to, you know, it was all split up like that.
And I guess I'll add that it was Atari and Commodore, but it was mostly Commodore in the US. Atari was getting a lot of its sales in Central and Eastern Europe by that point.
Yeah, but the MSX does have a long lifespan, and it is successful in all kinds of places. Mm-hmm. It just kind of just wherever they could get in, but apparently had a big following in the Middle East. And like there was the MSX could do like Arabic keyboards. I think I've heard mm-hmm. that it might have been Sega that developed like a Arabic standard keyboard that is still kind of being used today, but I don't know. I wouldn't know for sure, but a lot of stuff is happening with the MSX in like South America, I think a little bit, and Spain definitely was somewhat popular in Spain. So, you know, it found a chance, but I think by the time it got to Europe, it just seems like a lot of the European microcomputers were already there.
I was going to say, I've heard that the MSX did pretty well in Northern Europe. Because, you know, yeah, there were the Spectrum and the C64 and all the other players, but I feel like the MSX kind of outclasses a lot of those in a variety of ways in terms of what it's capable of. And I'm glad you mentioned the Middle Eastern Arabic version, because I remember, I think it was MAGFest 2020, they had one of those in their museum space and actually ran into the woman who brought it, and she was like, oh, yeah, you know, As a girl in Saudi Arabia, I wasn't really supposed to be able to use this, but who was going to stop me?
Sweet dreams are made of these. Who am I to disagree? I travel the world and the seven seas. Everybody's looking for something. Some of them want to use you. Some of them want to get used by you. Some of them want to
Okay, so one of the frustrating things about computer platforms is that the chronology and timelines of releases are very nebulous. According to Wikipedia's list, there were like 60 games released for MSX in 1983, but is that really true? Was that just the copyright date on these? Like, when in 1983 did they show up? Where did they show up? It's all very poorly documented, so it's kind of hard to say, you know, exactly how these games entered the market first, what kind of availability there was for software. But I do think it's interesting, you know, talking about the sort of idea of a standard that would be licensed out and become just kind of common. It's interesting that mindset drove the MSX with hardware that's so similar in so many respects to the SG-1000, because it seems like Sega had the same idea as well to a degree. So, you know, in 1983, July 1983, they launched the SG-1000 and its computer counterpart, the SE-3000. It hits Japan, also shows up in Europe where it doesn't do too much, and Australia where it actually does pretty well as the SE-3000, thanks to the local distributor, John Sands, who really pushes it hard as a computer platform and gives it, you know, a few years of life that's apparently pretty successful, pretty well, you know, pretty well spread across the country. But at the same time, you know, about 3 or 4 months after the the SG-1000 debuts, there's a clone hardware platform that launches called the Othello Multivision from Sakuda Original, the company whose real claim to fame is that they have a trademarked version of Reversi called Othello that they will just license to anyone and everyone. Nintendo had a big hit in arcades in the late 70s with their licensed take on Othello, and apparently that emboldened Sakuda Original to just say, we're gonna milk this thing. And they continued to release ports of Othello for more than a decade, but they had their own like little handheld systems to play Othello. And the Othello Multivision is SG-1000 hardware that has an Othello ROM built into it and has an 8-key, I wouldn't call it a keyboard, but there are, it's actually, no, 16 keys. It's 1 through 8 and A through H or whatever, that allow you to punch in coordinates for Othello. And that's, as far as I can tell, the only thing that's used for. But it had its own line of games, 8 games published by Sakuda, that could be played very easily. Just plug them in on an SG-1000 or SC-3000 and they run. Likewise, it was cross-compatible in the other direction where SG-1000 games could run on it. It lacked the expansion port that allowed you to plug in the keyboard to the SG-1000, so it couldn't do all of SC-3000 stuff and didn't have full support for SG-1000 peripherals. But other than that, it was basically like a semi-official clone of the SG-1000, and actually SG-1000 mentions, if you look at software, like it says compatibility SC-1000 or SG-1000, SC-3000, Othello Multivision, and there was also a Pioneer clone that was licensed out and was basically, it didn't have its own unique software and is largely forgotten. But yeah, like there was kind of this initial push to sort of turn the SG-1000, SC-3000 into a standard, but didn't really go anywhere. And the Othello Multivision fizzled out by the end of 1984 with only 8 unique games and just kind of vanished from that point. But still, like, there was something in the water. And I don't know how Sega ended up creating something so similar to the ColecoVision and MSX with such a similar strategy. It can't have been coincidence, but there's no record of the actual process behind the development of the SG-1000 besides, you know, the very, very vague outline you can read on like Wikipedia, which is sourced from, you know, like one or two places that don't offer any more information. And they spend more time talking about like, well, they ended up redesigning the hardware and the cartridges to get rid of the black console, the black cartridges, because someone at Sega thought they looked like tombstones and it was too grim. So they switched it to a card format. Like that's all you can really find. It's very frustrating. It's vexing for me, you know, after putting so much time into tracking the software library of the SG-1000 and covering it and kind of trying to look at how that fits into Sega's bigger history, you know, reaching between like a connection between their early arcade stuff and their later consoles and arcade games. It's annoying that so little is known about how the SG-1000 even came to be and the sort of strategies and decisions that drove it and ended up causing it to be so similar to these other platforms. It's madness.
I think everybody's stealing from each other.
Yeah, there's definitely some cross-contamination happening there, probably in some bars and smoky rooms.
I've heard that like the people who just worked in these industries, although they didn't necessarily move out of their own country necessarily, but they moved to a lot of different companies, and it just kind of, you know, again, they were still coming out of it from this 1970s hobbyist mindset of like, hey, let's all do this together. This is a project for us. And like the capitalistic impulses didn't necessarily always mesh with that. So I'd imagine there was just a lot of, hey, check this out. Oh, I can do that. Yeah.
I'd have to double check. I swear I've read somewhere that Sega was in talks with Coleco about putting the ColecoVision out in Japan, and that just never happened. And then a little while later, the SG-1000 turned up. Yeah,
they said, fine, we'll do it ourselves.
Yeah, I'd have to double check on that, but I feel like I've read that before.
the SG-1000 is interesting because it does, you know, especially in the early days of the software lineup, draw so heavily on Sega's arcade legacy. But the thing is, Sega released or licensed a whole bunch of games to Coleco, and there's almost no overlap between Sega on Coleco and Sega on SG-1000, despite the two platforms being almost identical under the hood. It's just the damnedest thing. I don't know if there was a limitation on what Sega could do themselves. I wouldn't think that would be the case, but Sega either internally developed its own SG-1000 games, its arcade ports, or shopped them out usually to Compile, who I think were working under the name Developers 3 at that point. Whereas Coleco apparently did all of its own programming and adaptations itself. But it's fascinating that you have games like Carnival and Turbo that were really big arcade hits for Sega and did really well in ColecoVision. Like, Turbo was popular and important to the point that Coleco released an entire peripheral around that one game, the driving controller. And it didn't show up on SG-1000. I think the only overlap is Planet of Zoom 909, Buck Rogers, whatever you want to call it. And you can kind of compare and contrast. And I actually think Coleco's version turned out better. And actually, everyone else did a better version of Congo Bongo than Sega did. Like, the SG-1000 version of Congo Bongo is shockingly garbage. I have no idea what happened there, but they got rid of the isometric viewpoint that defines Congo Bongo. Like, that is the big selling point. It's Donkey Kong, but with cool 3D style graphics, and they flatten it. So, like, it just becomes a bad Donkey Kong clone. It only has two stages, whereas Donkey Kong on Famicom, you know, it lost a stage, but it still had three. What a disaster.
Don't let this make you think that Congo Bongo and any other home platform is, like, really good.
Congo Bongo is not actually that good.
No,
but
they're better than the SG-1000 version, but they're still Congo Bongo, and they're still compromised ports of Congo Bongo on top of that.
Yeah. Well, they had this, like, the isometric thing, because when they put out Zaxxon, I think they kept kind of the same sort of thing, right? It looks kind
they
of
did,
like Zaxxon.
But it came out 2 years later. It was a 1985 game, so it took them that long to get around to it. I feel like they just kind of, I don't know, they had a hard time coming to terms with the home software or the home hardware. Maybe they were just used to dealing with more powerful platforms. But, you know, you look at their sort of early games, and the lead title for SG-1000, like the featured title, was called Starjacker, which was an arcade game that it was a vertical scrolling shooter that had a really interesting premise. It kind of looks like when you play it, it's like Gradius or something, where you've got the options behind you, but it's not options, it's other ships. But the thing is, those are your extra lives. So if one of those ships gets shot or collides with something, you lose a life. So you have to, like, protect four ships at once. And the game actually becomes a little easier as you start to lose lives because you have a smaller hitbox, basically. But also, all those ships flying around behind you, they're, you know, moving in unison with your main ship. They're firing. So you lose a lot of your firepower. It's a really weird... It's a weird design, but, you know, I guess that was the thing was, like, hey, it's a vertical shooter. You kids love Zevius, right? So here's this. But I think they push it because it's a scrolling game. It's the only scrolling game on SG-1000 at this point. And it's choppy, you know, because SG-1000 was like MSX and ColecoVision couldn't do smooth per pixel scrolling, but it moves fast enough that, like, the sort of stop-start, 8-pixel-at-a-time motion is not going to make you too barfy. And, you know, it's interesting because you look over at Nintendo's Famicom, which launched the same day as the SG-1000, and that has smooth hardware scrolling for multicolored sprites built in at the hardware level. Yet none of Nintendo's games in 1983 make use of the scrolling feature. So It just seems like both companies kind of took a while to figure out, like, what is our strength? What are our core strengths here? And they were really, I mean, you look at Nintendo's early library, and it's three arcade ports of fairly old games of varying accuracy. And then they repurpose graphics from those games to create some educational games. And then you've got the obligatory Japanese tabletop games, Mahjong, Shogi, Go. You know, those are the games that kind of pop up early in all these platforms' lives. And then there's also Mario Brothers and baseball. And they were kind of hitting the points that everyone wanted them to hit, but it just feels like they're both just sort of figuring things out at this point, which is really interesting because the console concept had been around and pretty well explored, you know, thanks to Atari and television, et cetera, for 6 or 7 years by this point. And both of these companies had some experience in the home market, Sega through Coleco and their ports, and Nintendo making their own, you know, standalone consoles. So right. I don't know. It's fascinating because neither of these systems got off to a really good start, to be honest. Like Nintendo, the Famicom was unquestionably more powerful than anything else on the market at the time. Like you look at the sprites and the action and motion, it's so smooth. Everything's running at 60 frames a second, just animating really clearly. It just looks good. Good colors, you know, a lot of colors on screen at once comparatively, you know, 4-color sprites, great stuff. But, you know, at the same time, the controllers are hardwired in to the console. You can't swap them out. And the very first wave of Famicoms shipped with buttons, and instead of being the round buttons we associate with the NES, the hard round plastic buttons, they're that sort of spongy plastic that was used on the select and start buttons, and they're square. And so the corners have a tendency to get caught under the frame of the controller and jam. So that's bad. And also there's a very rare but fatal CPU issue, a bug. And it was so bad that Nintendo recalled the hardware and replaced it. And around the same time, they also replaced the square controller buttons with round controller buttons that wouldn't stick. So, you know, the first 6 months of the Famicom's life, pretty rough. Like, not a lot of great games. Donkey Kong, yeah, sure, it looked almost arcade perfect, but it was missing a stage. And also, Donkey Kong was, like, 2.5 years old at that point. So, was that really, like, what the kids were clamoring for? I don't know. They wanted Zevius, and that wouldn't come until the end of 1984.
I think it's interesting when you talk about how they had the scrolling capability built into it, but none of their original games did. And I have to suspect that I wonder whether that was just forward thinking. I mean, to me, I would be so worried that it was going to bomb when it first came out that I would try to put something on it that really wowed people rather than putting the same kind of collection of games that every other platform launched with. Because when you look at like the Famicom launch titles, it's like, oh yeah, lame. But then you look at everybody else's launch titles and it's the same kind of stuff. You've got your edutainment to kind of sell it to the moms, and you got the arcade conversions because people know they like that. And the interesting thing is that because Nintendo went as cheap as they possibly could on this, but they did really think of it, I think, as a modular system originally. And they... how long did it take for the keyboard, the Fami Basic, and
It was about a year. It was summer of 84.
Yeah. So they had to have planned that in advance because they had to have like the IO stuff set up, and they had to have the port set up for the peripherals and stuff. So I don't know whether they planned specifically that, but I think that they
did actually. I was fortunate enough to interview the late Masayuki Uemura, the hardware designer, like 8 years ago, God. And he told me, you know, that he specifically designed the Famicom to be extensible, to put those expansion pins on the cartridge port to allow for future capabilities that he didn't know what those future capabilities would be. But there are these extra connections that the initial cartridges don't use on the cartridge port, and those would eventually be used on the Famicom disk system. They would be used in expansion cartridges like Konami's, you know, VRC6 and things like that. But at the time, it was just, you know, kind of adding this little bit of future-proofing without really knowing what would come of it. So yeah, there was there was that idea of like, you know, let's go beyond the capabilities here. And, you know, even the ROM, the way the game ROMs, the way they were set up, lent themselves to memory paging. So, you know, the initial wave of Famicom games were, I think, 16K. They were really small, and that's all the hardware can really address at a time. But then you introduce memory paging, and so it's like the game is, you know, the RAM is accessing 16 bits of memory or 16K of memory at a time and just switches out what is currently being addressed. So that allows you to have games that were, by the end of it, like 2 megabits or something. I think Metal Slater Glory is just like, there's no way Uemura said, oh yes, you know, Kirby's Adventure, Metal Slater Glory, let's build a console that can create these games. Like, those are beyond the conception of anyone in 1983. You know, 10 years later, these games would come along. But he did, you know, kind of have the foresight to say, you know, this doesn't have to be the end-all be-all of what this console can do, so we'll give it the ability to do more stuff, even if we don't know what that is. So yeah, some good thinking there. Like, that really, I think, went a long way toward turning the Famicom, the NES, into an enduring system that lasted for more than a decade.
I mean, you could argue that the console as we know it, the concept of a video game console, didn't really get solidified until maybe after Nintendo said, you know what, we're not supporting the disk drive anymore. It's just a game console. Like, because they had that ability to expand. And obviously, this is something more than one company had the idea to do, because, of course, as you just said, the SG-1000, they put out the computer version at the same time, right? Like, it was the SC-3000. And the naming convention is really great. One of the things I love is like these naming conventions, and almost everything for the SG-1000 or SC-1 is S something and then a number. And
And it's all right there. It's Sega SG-1000, Sega Game, SC-3000, Sega Computer, SK-1100, Sega Keyboard, SR-1000, Sega Recorder, BH-400. I think there's also SH-400, steering handle, bike handle.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's ridiculous. I don't know where the numbers came from. Like,
that's really
why are those
right?
there? But there's the, you know, like SJ-150, SJ-200, SJ-110. Those are all Sega joysticks.
Yeah. I mean, I know that a lot of times these model numbers get planned out in advance before they even know whether everything's going to get released. But I wonder whether they like, okay, we have the model numbers designed. Like, do all the numbers, if you added up all the numbers for all existing and planned peripherals, whether they add up to like some significant number in, like, I don't know, like Zen numerology or something, whether there's some kind of some kind of plan here. Because why is the keyboard 1100 and why is the computer get 3000 while the game console is 1000? I don't know, but
it's a great mystery.
You could find commercials for them selling the SG-1000 at the time, and you see all the different plans of attack they had for getting that, this thing in. Yeah,
something will stick.
Yeah, and that continued. You know, the SG-1000 underwent multiple iterations. So, you know, in addition to the Othello Multivision, the SC-3000, in 1984, they released the SG-1000-2. They didn't come up with, like, the SG-2000. It was the SG-1000-2, which was the same hardware, but it looked much better, much less toy-like, and, you know, sleeker 80s peak Japanese electronics design, really good. But it had removable joysticks, so you didn't have to have them hardwired anymore, which opened up a lot of opportunities for expansion, and also meant that if your joysticks went bad, which was inevitable with Sega's kind of iffy manufacturing quality, your whole console wasn't ruined.
And the SG-1000's joystick was a literal joystick.
Yeah, right? Yeah.
Like a side button, yeah.
Yep, and then the SG-1000-2 had more of like a Nintendo-style gamepad. And then in 1985, 2 years after the SG-1000 launched, you got the card catcher, which was a little thing that plugged into the joystick or the cartridge slot and allowed you to use card-based media, similar to TurboGrafx-Who cards, But this was like the standard format that they released the rest of the system's games on. So if you didn't buy the adapter, you were locked out of using future games for the SG-1000. But then 3 months after that, they released the Mark III, which was really a new console. It was the SG-1000 Mark III, you know, the idea there behind the name. But it had a new GPU. It had more RAM. It was the Master System, basically. And that still had the ability to support the keyboard. And there's actually, I discovered one game, a F-16 Fighting Falcon that was released for the Master System card system, card, you know, the My Cards or Sega Cards, whatever you want to call them. It's a port of an MSX game programmed by Yuji Naka. And he went kind of bonkers with it and added support for multiplayer, console to console multiplayer. So in order to do this, you have to have two Mark III systems. You have to plug in the SK-1000 keyboard and then either build or find a communications cable. It's like a 5-DIN cable that you plug between the two keyboards of the two systems. And both of these systems, with the keyboards running this card-based game, can play this, you know, kind of bad flight sim head-to-head. I don't know that anyone has ever done this, but it's right there in the manual. Someone has done it, I'm sure.
I guarantee you some nerds in Akihabara in like 1986 put this together and it has not been done since.
I'm sure people have done it since, but I can't find any video footage of what it looks like. I can't find any information on it besides the fact that in the manual, if you read it, it's like, hey, you can do this incredibly dumb, weird thing. But anyway, that's just like the kind of weird iterative life that the SG-1000 had. And that continued to iterate. The Master System hardware in America is a little different than the Mark III because it has support for light guns on the controller port that the Mark III didn't have, because the Mark III didn't have a light gun. It didn't have light gun based games. But then the final hurrah for this platform was in 1988, Sega released the Master System in Japan, which was a Mark III, but it looked like the American Master System, except it's a little taller. It has an FM sound processor built into it, which was released as a standalone unit for the Mark III. And it also has support for light guns, even though they never released any light gun games there. So it's like the ultimate iteration of the SG-1000, you know, kind of going through like four or five different permutations to finally arrive at the Japanese Master System, which truly does everything. Except I don't think it doesn't have the ribbon cable connector. So I guess it can't actually do the SC-3000 stuff, and you can't play F-16 Fighting Falcon head-to-head. So I'm sure Yuji Naka just hates that hardware so much. But otherwise, it's amazing. It's great.
I don't know when it came out, but it looked like there was a SP-400 four-color printer released for the SC-3000 only. I wonder whether that used that connector you were talking about, because I'd imagine that reminds me of the SCSI cables of days gone by.
Yeah, so that's the one peripheral that I was not able to find in the multiple years that I was working on SG-1000 works and putting together the book. I never saw one of those up for auction on eBay, on Japanese auction sites, you know, in little out-of-the-way Japanese shops on the internet. Even going to different shops in Japan last summer, like never seen it. Don't know that it really actually existed, aside from the fact that it's listed on, you know, Sega Retro. So I trust them that it existed. Also, apparently there was a custom computer desk that Sega released specifically for the SG-1000 or SC-3000, but like that's just silly. Like I don't even care.
I think the printer is hilarious, though, because I think it used this, even if you could find one, you couldn't get the paper for it because it doesn't use like normal printer paper.
I think it's like receipt paper, basically. It's, you know, the thermal paper that the Game Boy printer used, if I'm not mistaken. That's kind of my understanding.
So, like, what was the use case for this printer exactly? I mean, were there perforated lines on the paper so you could tear them off? Or was it just like, I'm going to turn in my book report? It's like this huge, like Jack Kerouac roll.
Obviously,
well, no, so it could be like, you know, the the Game Boy printer where it just has like a perforated edge on it, you know, a serrated edge on the printer. So there's just like this giant jagged blade along one end of the printer that children just pull paper from. And, you know, it's the 80s. Who cares about safety?
But that means there's some lawn no, darts. Like, standard, there's no like standard shape of the paper. So like if you're going to do anything other than like, I don't know, like send somebody like a letter or something, it wouldn't work, right? Because it wouldn't be a uniform size. That's what
it's taking you back to the age of like Ninja Scrolls, you know, like you just unfurl it and you've got your, yeah, I don't know.
I love stuff like that because like, I think didn't they put out like one of the first laser printers at some point in the 70s.
And
yeah, there was a lot of stuff going on. People were trying a lot of different things, but I just love that. This like, it's a printer, which at the time must've been really cool. It's a printer in your house. It uses like thermal receipt paper.
Yeah, Sega was doing some really cool stuff, like that summer into like the next couple of years with their SG-1000, and it's like they seemed pretty happy with how it did, given that they kept supporting the home market. It's just very funny because you look at this, you look at, you know, Starjacker and the other games that they had out, and you look at the Famicom coming along with like this controller that doesn't really work, but they're also hardwired in, and they have this, you know, quality control issue that, you know, they have to suck it up and eat a bunch of money to get this recall going. And they expected to sell like 500,000 of these things that first year, according to some trade press I saw. And somehow this becomes like the world beater machine in Japan and eventually the US as well. It's very funny. Like, you look at this early stage and you're like, it could have gone either way, honestly.
Yeah, that's exactly right. And I think the real pivotal moment for the Japanese consoles industry was a year later when Hudson started publishing its own games, and they had a really close relationship with Nintendo. And I mean, they put together basically the basic, like the family basic keyboard program. So, you know, they basically released first party games that weren't, I mean, if you look at the early Hudson games, the packaging is exactly the same as Nintendo's Pulse line. It's, you know, even down to the stuff on the back, their title screens look just like first party Nintendo title screens for the black box games. But that, you know, they broke away from Nintendo's, the idea of Nintendo as a first party exclusive publisher, the only company publishing games on Famicom. And then Namco joined in. And then, you know, the following year, you had a bunch of other companies. And by the end of 1985, it's just a free-for-all. And Nintendo, I don't think they my understanding is that they didn't want that to happen at first. But once it did happen, and Hudson and Namco kind of forced their hand, they said, okay, let's come up with a licensing structure and, you know, make this work for everyone. And Sega never did that. You had Sega bring in some third-party games. Like, they released Galaga a year before Galaga hit Famicom. And it was called Sega Galaga, which is a terrible name. It's like Sega Gaga, but nope, just Sega Galaga.
Galaga.
And, you know, there were a few third-party publishers who licensed their games in. Konami, Namco, Jalico, and Sega published all of those themselves. And I think that, you know, that kind of deterred those publishers, those developers from moving ahead with Sega, because, you know, Sega was taking a big percentage of the cuts as publisher, whereas Nintendo was saying, yeah, you can self-publish, you can manufacture your own ROMs, just give us a licensing fee. So they could basically call their own shots, manufacture their own yields, you know, do everything and take a much better share of things, so that Nintendo system was much more appealing to publishers, third-party publishers, than Sega's first-party only system. And Sega wouldn't open up to third parties until 1988. Mark III had a couple of games by Stalio, which it was a spinoff of Tecmo. And, then Master System, you know, Activision and Milton Bradley and a couple of, or Parker Brothers, I think, started publishing on Master System in 88. But up until that point, everything on Sega platforms was Sega. So, you know, that was, I think that was very limiting. And really, even if it brought in more money for Sega, you know, up front by taking a bigger cut as publisher, I think it ultimately limited their appeal. And, you know, Sega, Nintendo would start taking a bigger slice of the pie once Famicom really caught on and became kind of the undeniable hit that everyone wanted to be on. They restructured their licensing terms and said, okay, third parties, you need to give us more money. And that created a rift with Namco. Right. Because Namco was like, hey, you know, would the Famicom really have been as big a hit without Zevius and Galaxian and Mappy and Pac-Man? You guys kind of owe us. And Nintendo said, no, you owe us. So, you know, Namco kind of, they continued publishing on Famicom, but they didn't license themselves officially for NES until 1993. And they, you know, really, really threw in their chips with the PC Engine, and then with the Mega Drive and Genesis, TurboGrafx, you know, like they were really quick to focus on those other platforms and kind of minimize their contributions to Famicom once those other options became available.
I mean, they tried to stage like kind of a mutiny in the United mm-hmm. States market because they threw in their chips with Tengen. Right. And Tengen's whole thing was like, well, I don't care if we're not licensed. We can still make software for your device. It's just like everything else. Like, you know, they did it to Atari back in the day. We'll do it now. And Namco's like, we agree with you. We'll give you our games, put out some Pac-Man games. And but that's getting ahead of ourselves a little bit of that's a later development. And at this time though, you're right. Like I think people were still thinking, well, we're going to support this ourselves. And it's fascinating to look at because every one of these platforms, the SC-3000, I love trade dress. Maybe I'm that kind of dork, I guess. But I love how they have this like design concept for their boxes. It's all going to look like this. And the commercials kind of match up. And I was surprised on the commercials when they ended those things. It had the Sega, which I thought was like a Genesis era thing. I thought that was like a Mega Drive thing, but it's not. Does anybody know anything about that?
I know nothing. Just the fact that it was around back in the early 80s.
Yeah. And what I've heard is that the SG-1000, probably in the first few years, it sold pretty well compared to the Famicom. It didn't beat it, but it was, they were making, you know, money, I think.
Yeah, Sega sold like something like three or four times as many of these systems as they expected. And so even though it didn't match the Famicom's numbers, they were like, this is a good idea. Let's keep making home games. And so it never became home gaming didn't really become a core focus until the 90s for them, I would say. But it was definitely a thing that they did, and they put a lot of effort into and a lot of money into. And they stumbled along the way. But, you know, without the SG-1000, we never would have had the Genesis. And that was really kind of where modern day Sega fandom comes from. It's either that or the arcades. But that was kind of their peak era. And, you know, the SG-1000 kind of paved the way for that.
RIP to the zillion fans.
And, you know, the Famicom also paved the way for Nintendo, which continues to be a first-party concern of some note. Like, they're still doing really, really well for themselves. Yeah, I think the Switch is now the second or third best-selling console of all time.
And like Zelda, of course, just came out a month ago, the Tears of the Kingdom. And this is like when I was researching for this, it's like the first night in several weeks where I haven't been doing that. And it's now like a phenomenon on, it seems like it, I heard like NPR stories and stuff about Tears of the Kingdom. Right. And it reminded me of like, man, I remember when these stories were about like the original Nintendo. It's the same.
The British government is blaming their recession on Tears of the Kingdom. I just saw this article a couple of days ago. Like, yes, it's the Zelda effect because people are playing Tears of the Kingdom instead of working. I don't know about that, buddy, but okay, you do you.
I think that says more about what the British government's up to than the broader society.
Yeah.
Don't look at anything they did in the last 8 years and you might believe the Zelda thing. Uh-huh. But yeah, it's funny because this is kind of the beginning of the console, especially the licensing scheme, right? Because that is how stuff is sold today. In fact, that's how like the business model for creating a game console still works today. We're going to sell this for barely any profit, and we're going to charge licensing fees so developers can access our market, and we'll make our money back that way. And it'll be interesting to see whether like Microsoft tries to take it back into a more like modular, less generational hardware standard, which I'm sure nobody is thinking that's what we're going to do, the MSX thing. We're going to do the old microcomputer thing, but it could,
well, you know, 3DO is such a big success.
Yeah. Everyone loves 3DO. That's why they ported all the games on 3DO to everything else.
It's just interesting. It really is. Like, it's, you go back in time and you can see that none of these problems were really solved yet, but the solutions were right there. And it just was a matter of waiting long enough to see who came out on top and what business model was going to work. And, you know, it's just funny that in a lot of ways, the same kind of difference between the PC market and the console market kind of continues, even though now there's once again getting to the point where there's not a lot of difference between the two.
Yeah, so that pretty much wraps up what I wanted to talk about this episode, is that, you know, you look back 40 years this month, this week, and you see two of the most momentous events in video game history happen on the same day. And yet, when you really look at the full context, it's not like everything instantly changed that moment. It was just part of an overall continuity, you know, of two more events that just happened to have huge ripples that spread outward. But there was no way to know at the time that that would have been the case. Again, you know, like these console releases were not even noted in the trade community, the trade publications of the era in the West. Like, there was no assumption that we were seeing like the future of video gaming right here, and that the course of the industry was being determined by these two companies and the systems that they launched in July of 1983. So I don't know. It's just kind of cool I don't know. I think it's cool. I think weird things are cool. I have, you know, different priorities than most people, but I wanted to look back at this crucial moment in video game history with kind of a fresh perspective, and to say, like, you know, in the context of its era, how did this look? And I really feel like it didn't look like much of anything at all. It was just two more systems entering increasingly crowded markets and, you know, noise within the chaos that could have been swallowed up, but they weren't swallowed up and they survived. And that's really down to great software design, great support, just two companies that really decided to invest in this medium and put great talent to work and appeal to people who wanted to play video games. So,
yeah,
I'm going to say that's what it was.
Yeah. And I mean, just really quick, just looking,
final thoughts.
We talk about the definitions of like, the way that this kind of set some standards for like the marketplace in the future. It also kind of changed it was the beginning of the change of the cultural perceptions of Japan and like how people think of the country and how the country like does its tourism stuff now and marketing. And like when they had the Olympics in Japan a few years ago, and you know, they did their opening ceremony, it was all video game music. You know, it's like, mm-hmm. It starts here. Back in 1983, it's not, that wouldn't necessarily have happened from coin operated games, but it was the kind of weird confluence of events that put a few particular Japanese companies ahead, and it defines them forever now, or at least for a while. So and of course nobody could have planned that.
Kevin, final thoughts?
I always think it's very fascinating because, you know, prior to the summer of 83, you know, the Japanese home console market is barely a blip, mm-hmm. Whereas you look at
think that the Bandai WaveJack and the SuperVision 8000 were world-shaking events?
Oh, you're right, yeah. It was just like this tiny little niche within a niche. You look at Europe, it was also kind of a niche, like, you know, maybe you'd get people who cared about the 2600 or like the video pack, depending on where you were. But, you know, they were all in on computers over there. And then you look at the US and, you know, video game home consoles were massive. They were huge for years. And this is the year where they're just like falling apart rapidly for several different reasons, mostly self-inflicted. And it's just very... It's an interesting dichotomy to me. You know, you have one group rising up while this other one is just completely nosediving off a cliff. And then, the other group's just sort of hanging out doing their own thing.
I agree. Anyway, thanks for taking the time to indulge me in my desire to look back 40 years and say, what was that all about? It was interesting. So thank you both for your insights, and please let us know where we can find you on the internet. This is a patron exclusive episode, I believe. Let me check, but I'm pretty sure. So I don't need to tell people listening where they can find Retronauts because they already know because they're right here. Yep, this is patron exclusive. So thank you, patrons, for making episodes like this possible, and I hope you have enjoyed it. But Rob, where can we find you on the internet?
Yeah, so if you know the Hardcore Gaming 101 website, I'm not technically really doing anything for the website, but I do their podcast. I've been doing it for years. I don't know what'll be coming out by the time you hear this, but we've got a lot. We do a show called Top Games, and it's basically just people nominate games that could come from any time period, any platform. We try to play them, and then we rank them on the list of games that we've already ranked. And it could be anything. I just did, I think what just came out yesterday when we're recording this was Dragon Warrior 7/Dragon Quest 7 for the 3DS and PlayStation.
We played all 9,000 hours of it?
Yes, we did.
Wow.
If you add up what we all did together, yes.
Did you beat God? Like the Yahweh God bonus boss?
Yeah, like the actual, Judeo-Christian God. Mm-hmm. Yeah, the Tetragrammaton.
Yes.
Yeah, we did that. So we've been doing that for a while, but you can always check us out. And Kevin's been on the show several times, too. He's almost a regular at this point.
Yeah, whenever you have a topic that finds me interesting, I'll be there. So you can find me all over the place. I'm on Twitter at Ubersaurus and Blue Sky. I just got an account there like 2 days ago.
Oh, I need one of those invites, thanks.
Well, whenever I can have one, I'll send one along. I'm on Mastodon at hubris@mastodon.social. I have a video series on YouTube under Atari Archive and a Patreon under the same name and a book under the same name, Atari Archive Volume 1, on sale through Limited Run Games and, you know, eventually Amazon as well. And, I'm all over the place, blathering on about old video games.
And you can find me, Jeremy Parrish, at the usual places. I'm sure you've heard by now, so I don't need to reiterate. But I will mention again that I have created video series NES Works Gaiden and SG-1000 Seigaiden that look at the entirety of the SG-1000 lineup and all of Nintendo's Famicom releases through the end of 1985. So if you want to get more context about what exactly they were doing back then and this period that we just talked about in this podcast, that's an okay source to go to. Although I will say that the SG-1000 videos are... there's a lot of inaccuracies and guesswork in those that have been cleared up since. So I will encourage you to instead buy the SG-1000 Works book when it launches next month, because I cleaned up all that stuff as best as I could, got the chronology of game releases correct based on contemporary resources, and just tidied things up so that all the errors in the videos are hopefully resolved, and it is the definitive work on the SG-1000. So that'll be next month through Limited Run Games, SG-1000 Works, Seigaiden Volume 1. And anyway, that's about it. So, go play some SG-1000 and Famicom games. Celebrate 40 years of these damn systems. They've been bringing children and adults joy for so long. 4 decades, my God.